Council, as you may have noticed, there's a judge missing. But Judge Ginsburg, who is another member of this panel, will listen to the argument later today. And I understand Council have been informed of that and agreed.
Yes, so, thank you.
When you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Sam Forstein, appearing on behalf of the Securities and Exchange Commission. With the Court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. In the spring of 2002, the Securities and Exchange Commission made the difficult but necessary decision to implement a new pay system providing a substantial raise for each and every one of its employees without awaiting a decision from the Federal Service Impasses Panel. While respecting its bargaining obligation, the Commission concluded that prompt implementation was necessary because delay would have impeded the agency's ability to effectively and efficiently carry out its mission. Several factors contributed to the Commission's decision. In the months preceding implementation, Congress had passed pay parity legislation, taking the SEC off the GS pay scale and permitting it to pay salaries comparable to those of other FERIA agencies. The Office of Personnel Management had approved a reprogramming of funds for fiscal year 2002 to enable the SEC to pay raises. The recent Enron and WorldCom scandals had deeply shaken the securities markets and increased the SEC's workload.
Congress didn't give the SEC the authority to do this unilaterally, however, right?
No, Congress authorized the SEC to pay more than the GSA scale. It did not say that it could do it unilaterally.
And Congress could have done so if it thought the crisis were that severe.
Congress could have done so, although Congress acknowledged that the crisis was severe.
Asked for that?
The SEC did not seek such authorization. And finally, the SEC's workload had increased substantially in the period before implementation, and the House of Representatives had passed what was later to become the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002, which imposed a series of sweeping new responsibilities upon the Commission with short time deadlines. The Commission had been short-staffed for many years already. SOX was going to increase the Commission's responsibilities. And the Commission concluded that to fail to act could jeopardize its ability to perform its mission. Ultimately, several months later, in November of 2002, the Federal Service Impasses Panel approved the pay plan submitted by the SEC with only minor modification. And in the 18 months following implementation, departures from the agency decreased significantly.
If you had allowed the impasse procedure to play out, in other words, if you'd gone all the way through to that, I guess it's the FSIP process, how would that really have changed what was happening in the agency? Couldn't you still have done all of these raises retroactively?
You mean after the FSIP had ruled? If we had done that, we did not know how long it was going to take the FSIP to rule. It was an indefinite period of time, which turned out to be several months and to extend into the next fiscal year. But the problem was that we had an immediate crisis, and if we delayed to the FSIP ruling and were unable to tell employees at the time we did that they had substantial raises coming, we would have had continued attrition at the very high rate that it was already occurring, plus we would have not been able to recruit effectively, as had been a problem for many years, because our salaries were lower than those not only of the private sector, but the other FERIA agencies. And so what we were able to do by immediate implementation was to promise recruits that they were going to get a salary comparable to those of the other FERIA agencies and substantially above salaries provided under the general schedule applicable for other federal employees.
Well, my question is, though, how would it have been different? In other words, couldn't you had the Pay Parity Act, so everybody knew that salaries were going to increase at the SEC at some point, right? So wouldn't you still have been able to recruit and to tell employees that, you know, help is on the way? We just don't know exactly when, but it'll be retroactive to some date.
Well, as far as it being retroactive, there was a legal question there about retroactivity. The commission's executive director, relying upon GAO precedents, was concerned that unless the money could be obligated in fiscal year 2002, that money would not be available for raises in fiscal year 03. So to simply...
Go ahead.
But my question is, why couldn't you obligate the money in the same way that you did, which is to say, you know, whenever this is resolved, we're going to pay these raises retroactive to that date, what, May 19th or whatever date the agency chose. Were you precluded from doing that?
The executive director concluded after reviewing the GAO precedents that he could not do that because simply saying that you're going to get a retroactive raise of an uncertain amount was not obligating the money, that he had to be able to obligate a particular plan with particular amount of raises, and he could not do that absent a specific plan going into effect.
But Judge Brown's point still stands, doesn't it? Even if the raises couldn't be retroactive, you could recruit people with the, maybe not assurance, but likelihood that a raise would be coming in a few months.
You could tell someone, we expect that you're going to get a raise. We couldn't tell them a particular
amount. I guess trust us is not always a great recruiting tool. But
And remember, we had tried, the agency had tried various inducements for many years prior to this, mm-hmm. with short-term success, a lot of failures, and a continuing problem. And we knew that Sarbanes-Oxley was coming down the line very shortly, and as detailed in our brief, it imposed a myriad of new responsibilities on the commission at a time when the commission was already short-staffed 280 employees and was going to have to require hire an additional 100 employees just to meet the time obligations of SOX. So yes, the commission could have said, you know, we anticipate you're going to get a pay raise at some time in the future, and we don't know how long that's going to be because we have no way of anticipating how long it would take the FSIP to rule. But that's a far cry from being able to say your salary as of May 19 is going to be X if you come to the agency. I mean, it's a very different situation.
So I asked you the question about whether the SEC asked Congress for this authority or whether Congress provided it. The SEC is an agency in the executive branch, right?
Correct.
And so is the FLRA. Was there any, which raises an interesting justiciability question, but we'll put that aside. Was there any mechanism in the executive branch for resolving this kind of issue?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. There are, in essence, two questions before the court. First, whether under the extraordinary circumstances I've described, the commission committed an unfair labor practice by implementing without awaiting the results of the FISA process. And second, if the court concludes there was an unfair labor practice, whether any monetary relief is permissible under the Back Pay Act, given that each and every SEC employee received a raise upon implementation of the new system, and there was no withdrawal or reduction of the pay of even a single employee.
Well, let me ask you about that. Maybe you can help me with the math here, because, and that may take some doing, but, as I understand it, every employee got a 6% increase before being moved to that new system. Is that correct?
That's not correct.
Well, I thought I read that in the ALJ's decision. So you said everybody got an increase, but you meant just the movement to the new pay system, not that they got an increment before that.
That's correct. There was no automatic 6% increase before that.
Well, then that makes sense. What the argument then that if they had gotten their WIGI, I guess, the
WIGI, W-I-G-I. Within grade increase is known as a WIGI.
That if they had gotten that, some of them at least, those whose increases would have fallen in that between May and November, would have started at a higher level. That's the argument.
But it makes and I'll address the back pay argument first because I think it can be addressed quickly, but it is an important argument, and I don't want it to be subsumed by the remainder of the argument. A couple of points. The FLRA receives no deference in interpretation of the Back Pay Act, and the FLRA has the burden of proof to show a violation of the Back Pay Act. The Back Pay Act requires that there be an unjustified personnel action, and that unjustified personnel action result in the withdrawal or reduction of someone's pay. So for purposes of Back Pay Act analysis, you look at the salary immediately before the so-called unjustified personnel action. Here, the salary under the GS system in effect as of May 18. And you compare it to the employee's salary the next day upon implementation of the new system, May 19. If you perform that analysis, as shown in the exhibit, which is part of the record, where we set forth the salary before and after of every member of the bargaining unit, each and every employee received a raise. In fact, a fairly substantial raise.
But is that the right inquiry? Isn't the inquiry into what the employees otherwise would have obtained?
Right. I suggest that it is the right inquiry, but even if you go to the next level and you say you have to look at the entire period and see what would have happened, the amount of the pay raise that each person received under the new pay system exceeds the amount of any WIGI that anyone would have received.
So what's really at stake
in a 4.5 month period?
What's really at stake on the back pay side of this case?
A fairly potentially substantial amount of money, depending upon.
Well, how is that if you're right that everyone got a big raise and it exceeded what they would have gotten with their step increases?
If we're right and that's the analysis, they get nothing. But the FLRA's position is a little bit different. The FLRA's position says, assume that despite the fact that there's a limited pot of money here for pay raises, you must assume that everyone would have gotten the same raise they got otherwise and add a WIGI on top of
On top of that.
For every employee who would have gotten a WIGI.
They want
to award a windfall to every single employee who would have gotten a WIGI. Unless you accept their analysis that the raises under the new system would have been the same and they should have gotten a WIGI on top of those raises, then there can be no monetary relief under the Back Pay Act. And that's what the argument is about with respect to monetary relief. But I want to turn to the question of whether there was a ULP in the first place, because the agency strongly believes that the exception to the rule of completion of bargaining should apply here for any number of reasons. In the first place, we submit that the decision of the FLRA is arbitrary and capricious because it rests upon two factual findings which are clearly unsupported by the record. First, the FLRA found that when the Commission's executive director testified that if the money was obligated in FY02, it could carry over to FY03, that meant that the money would be available in 03 even if it was not committed in 02. That's belied by the record.
Didn't the director also say that there would likely be another pot of money available, which there almost certainly would have been?
There could have been, but he also said that the SEC had operated under continuing resolutions for a number of years, and the likelihood was that if this money were not all spent for the purpose, it would be used for a continuing resolution for funding operations in the following year. So they'd have to go back and seek new authorization for funding for the pay raises.
Where did this pot come from? Didn't this come from an OMB reprogramming?
It came from an OMB reprogramming of fees collected in accordance with various fee collection.
So it could have come, the pot for 03 could have come from an appropriation or from another OMB reprogramming, I gather.
It could have. But as I say, for many years, the Commission had operated on a continuing authorization.
It seems unlikely, given what you said about Sarbanes-Oxley, that the pot of money that Congress would have ignored those increased obligations on the SEC and not given increased funding, although.
But again, it's speculative. We don't know that with a certainty. The second incorrect factual finding was that employees received no benefit from implementation on May 19 because the money was not actually paid out until August. The fact of the matter was that all the employees knew they were getting a raise and that money was accruing and would be paid to them retroactively when the Department of the Interior could administer the payroll. And the agency received the benefit of knowing that it could recruit on the basis of additional salaries as of that point in time. I see that my time is about up, but I did want to emphasize that this is a case where there is no clear reasoned path to the FLRA's decision. There's no meaningful distinction of the critical precedent here, the Border Patrol case. There are incorrect factual findings. There's a confusion of the burden of proof, which they concede is preponderance of the evidence, but they litter their opinion with terms such as heavy burden, and this is a demanding standard, it's a rather demanding standard, all of which go to a clear and convincing standard and not a preponderance of the evidence standard, which is in effect here. And in essence, we have an unprincipled ruling which cannot be squared with the obligation to provide a reasoned opinion if you're going to try and claim that you're not in an arbitrary and capricious status. I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. It's not disputed that the SEC unilaterally implemented changes in conditions of employment of their bargaining unit employees, and they did it before they completed their bargaining obligation, which in the federal sector, of course, includes.
That's permitted on occasion, though, right?
There are exceptions, and that is what they're claiming here, that they are entitled to the exception given the term the necessary functioning exception.
And you don't think it was necessary to the functioning of the SEC?
No. What was not necessary, what the burden.
Why are you better positioned to make that assessment than the SEC?
Because that is the job that Congress gave the FORA. Mm-hmm. Congress gave the FORA the job to administer the labor relations program, and this is ultimately a labor relations question, a collective bargaining question. The issue is, did the SEC meet its burden to show that the urgency of implementation on May 19 was of sufficient magnitude to override the statutory obligation to bargain? That's just the kind of question that Congress delegated to the authority. I think the HHS case that we submitted on a 28J, Judge Silberman made that point as clear as could be, that it's the judgment, those questions are left to the judgment and expertise of the authority, and that's what Congress intended. The authority determined here that the agency had not met that burden.
The record's pretty clear that the SEC needed help. And
certainly
with the
help.
Benefit of hindsight, we really know that.
Certainly they needed help, and that's not disputed. And when the authority talked about the heavy burden, the heavy standard, the standard is not that implementation is helpful to the mission or desirable, but rather that it is necessary to prevent the mission from being impeded. And that's got to be sufficiently strong to override the other bargain that Congress has given the SEC, namely the obligation to bargain. Judge Kavanaugh, you were absolutely correct. The Congress could have worded the discretion given to SEC to avoid any bargaining obligation,
right,
but they did not.
To help you out, the Congress did do that with some other agencies.
That's right. They have. You can express the discretion as notwithstanding any other law, but they did not do that. There are facts in the record that belie the urgency to implement on May 19. SEC could have done numerous things. There was no rush to get to the bargaining table. As the authority noted, even when they announced the implementation, there was no actual implementation. And as the court noted, there were alternatives that could have been done early on, notifying the employees that the raises were coming. The employees knew. The employees.
We hear that all the time.
The employees knew the raises were coming.
People always hear raises are coming, but that, until it's there.
Well, that's true, but what the employees knew probably, their union was bargaining for raises, that there was a proposal on the table from the agency, the one that was in fact implemented. And their union was bargaining for even greater raises.
Part of this was about recruiting new people.
Right? That's true.
And, you're not going to leave a high-paying job and take a pay cut to go work in government on the promise of a potential. At least if you have any knowledge of government, you're not going to do that on the promise.
But with respect to that, Your Honor, the record is also clear that these raises, the SEC essentially admitted this, even with these raises, they couldn't compete with the private sector. And that these raises were on the low end of the other FORIA agencies, such as the FDIC. So, the raises, the immediate impact of these raises on either retention or recruitment is, I think, somewhat speculative. Unless there are other questions, I think the record stands.
Can you clear up on the Back Pay Act? I want to make sure I understand that exactly right.
The Back Pay Act requires three things. that there be a unjustified or unwarranted personnel action, that there was a withdrawal or reduction in any part of pay, and that there was a causal relationship between those. Mm-hmm. Certainly, assuming the authority is correct on the merit, there was an unwarranted personnel action, namely the unfair labor practice. With guaranteed salary increases, within grade increases, were withdrawn from a certain subset of employees. And that was caused by the unilateral implementation of a compensation plan that
would the remedy be on top of the pay increase that they?
Well, that's the thing. What the Back Pay Act also provides that any losses be offset by any monies actually earned. Mm-hmm. Now, what's going on here? The SEC is complaining, well, nobody actually lost any money. Well, that's not in the record. The record does not show that. Those sorts of issues are to be resolved in compliance.
Yeah. So that's premature, you would say.
I think it is.
The only issue before us is the Back Pay Act legal question as far as figuring out who gets what and when. And
that's right. That's a compliance issue. That's standard practice in labor law.
Okay. What about if the executive branch concluded that this was a real problem? Is there anyone in the executive branch who's on top of the FLRA, or is the FLRA final?
The FLRA operates as an independent agency, and there is, of course, the chairman and the members report to the president, who appoints them.
The president told the FLRA to do something different here. Would the FLRA have done it?
I assume if the president gave such a personal directive, I assume that the FLRA would abide by that directive. But that hasn't happened. It hasn't happened in the almost 30
one
years of our
existence. One of those great unanswered questions, yes.
Pardon me?
It's one of those great unanswered questions, yes. Okay.
If there are no further questions, we submit on our brief, and I will yield to my colleague from the union.
Good morning. May it please the court. Barbara Shahi with the National Treasury Employees Union, the intervener in this case. I want to hit on a couple of points in the 4 minutes that I have. The first one as to the Back Pay Act. I just want to be clear on what the reduction here that's being claimed, because that's the key, is was there a reduction in pay? When the SEC implemented its pay system, there had to be a formula to convert employees from an old system to a new system, because it was different. There were different steps, there were different grades. So what they did under the formula, there was a base pay of what employees were making now. So that was the starting point. You then took, and I think they did other things to it. There was an increase. I think that's actually where the 6% comes in. It was part of the formula. You took, but what was important, you took the base pay, plugged that into the formula, did everything to that number that you were going to do, and then put them on the new system. Where the reduction occurred is that if you suspended illegally within grade increases, my very first number that got plugged into the formula to calculate my salary was wrong. So I'm wrong then on the new system. I should have gone in, say, if my within grade gave me an extra $1,000, my base pay in the formula should have been $1,000 higher when they converted me to the new system. So we can
That's
see.
That's not really a reduction.
I finish, Your Honor, respectfully it is. I finish in the plus column. I don't finish where I should have finished, however, because the agency didn't allow me. It illegally truncated my salary. So respectfully, it is a reduction.
You finish higher than you would have finished had there been no Pay Parity Act at all.
And there was a finding, actually, by the ALJ that there were some employees that fared better under the old system if they had simply gotten their within grade increase and then been left alone, that they fared better under the new system, under the old system, rather, the prior system, before the Pay Parity Act.
Would have fared better with a step increase than under the pay parity system.
Exactly. And
that's got to be a small group, though, I would imagine.
Certainly, but that in and of itself is a finding under the Back Pay Act that there was a reduction in pay. So that's not grounds. The fact that that's a small group is not grounds for reversal. It's something that will be worked on in a compliance hearing.
So
how many people?
That's one group, but you're saying something different here.
Absolutely. There are two discrete groups of people. The second group of people, the agency, had they allowed employees who got satisfactory performance to go through the system from May 19 to November 8th, there's a group of employees that would have received within grade increases had they obtained satisfactory performance on their evaluation. Had they left those employees alone and waited until they lawfully were able to implement their system, those employees would have had a higher number of higher salary when they got plugged into the formula. So the fact there's no basis for the argument that you finished in the plus column anyway, everything, no harm, no foul. The difference is I would have finished higher. My pay increase would have been higher. My pay increase, so that's a reduction under the PACT Act.
Got a double dipping aspect to it.
Only if you accept that the agency acted lawfully. If they didn't, we're right under the Back Pay Act, or were when the agency would have done its salaries. We're
even assuming you're right on the unfair labor practice part, to get a higher base based on the old system as you convert to the new system.
But at some point, you have to set a cutoff date administratively for when employees will be converted. So any employee that was due a within grade, respectfully, that's just what they would have gone in under the old system. Under the agency's Pay Parity Act, they had to convert the employees. It's not a windfall. It's simply waiting for the agency to lawfully implement its system.
But this, just so I'm clear, this is not really before us because this will be worked out in compliance?
In the compliance hearing, but because the agency at the very least has the union and the FLRA at the very least on the ALJ's findings have shown that there's the ALJ found that there was a discrete group of individuals who would have fared better. And the agency, I know, disputes that, but that's something for the compliance hearings.
If you're right, does that mean then that the agency wouldn't have been able to promise this retroactively? They would have created the same problem, right?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand.
In other words, part of what the ALJ says is, well, this wasn't all that critical because they could have achieve the same thing by just promising the employees that this was going to happen whenever, you know, they completed the bargaining process. But if that's the case, then you're kind of saying, actually, they would have created the same problem, right? Because
I don't think the FLRA or the union is putting that forward. I think what we agree with is that the agency could have accomplished, as you noted at the beginning, the agency could have accomplished exactly everything that it did. All it needed to do was communicate to employees, you'll be getting a pay raise. They couldn't identify the amount. They could say it's at least as much as we're proposing, but it could be what the union's proposing, which is more. They just didn't have a date certain on which that would happen. But that brings me to a point, actually, that the agency absolutely, as the ALJ found, manipulated the timing of events here. They manipulated they created an artificial urgency for bargaining, then relied on that self-created situation to unilaterally implement its own system. They had the authority from Congress on January 16, 2002, to bring their employees off the general schedule and put them and compensate them at a higher level. The day after Congress acted, the national president and the National Treasury Employees Union sent a letter to the SEC asking them to bargain, recognizing that pay increases for employees was in the mutual interest of the union and the agency, requested a bargaining the day after. That request went largely ignored for several months. The next the agency did was the 15 months leading up to the passage of the act and the 1 or 2 months after the passage, so into March 2002, they were working with a consulting group to develop a pay plan. So they had everything in the works for 15 months. At no point during that 15 months did they communicate with the union what their intentions were. They didn't bring the union into the process. They didn't seek their input. Now, to be clear, they didn't have to. But to then claim that we didn't have time to bargain with the union ignores that they had every opportunity to involve the union to expedite the process. And then again, on April 18th, they set the date of implementation. That was before bargaining ever even began. The SEC chairman communicated to employees that his hope was that implementation would occur on May 19th. The parties didn't even sit down to bargain until April 22nd, 2002. And that was more than three months after the union requested bargaining. And then the ALJ found that at that point, when that communication went from the SEC chairman to the employees, that's when May 19th took on the life of its own. There's nothing in the record to establish the critical nature of May 19th. In fact, the only thing in the record, I'm sorry, I see that my time has expired. Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
May it please the court. On its terms, the necessary functioning test is not a particularly difficult test to meet. All that the agency has to do.
It's only been met once, right?
That's right. But
which implies that it actually is pretty difficult.
Well, in fact, we've had terminology just now reference to it being a reasonably strong test. And the problem that we have here is that Congress, in the labor statute, said that the FLRA must balance two things. It must protect the rights of unions, but it must balance those rights against the effective and efficient administration of government. In fact, Section 5501B of their own governing statute requires the FLRA to take into account effective and efficient government as part of its operation. And this court has said in a case more than 20 years ago, aptly entitled NTEU versus FLRA, decided in 1987 that a failure to take that balancing into effect is error on the part of the FLRA. When the FLRA speaks in terms of the necessary functioning test...
They did the balance, you just don't like the way they struck it, and under our precedence, it's the FLRA who gets the deference here, whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, that's...
I'd respect
for us to really
they didn't
determine.
Do any balancing, Your Honor. That's mm-hmm. I think that's part of the problem. When they respond to the SEC's argument that some deference should be granted by saying any deference at all would cause the exception to swallow up the rule, that to me is indicative that there is no balancing at all going on. Mm-hmm. And what really should have happened is they should have said, yes, as with other predictive judgments within an agency's sphere of expertise to which the court grants deference, we should have granted the SEC some deference here, which it did not do, because the ALJ routinely substituted his judgment for that of the agency. They then should have said, granting that deference, let's balance that against protection of the union and decide which wins in this case. That analysis simply didn't take place at all. What they said is, we can't grant any deference because if we do, it's going to swallow up the rule. And I think what has happened is one of the two prongs that the FLRA is entitled to follow fell by the wayside in this case. We had such a concern for protecting union rights that we had no concern at all for the effective and efficient administration of government. And I think that's one of the problems. On the Back Pay Act, let me just say that all the evidence the court needs is in the record here. You have before you at A8, Exhibit A8, page 533 of the Joint Appendix, the chart showing salaries of all employees before and after, and you have the WIGI chart at page 35 of the appendix to the SEC's brief, which shows the WIGI that each employee could have received during that time period. And the burden of proof here is on the FLRA to show.
Are they right that there's a compliance aspect to this that would sort out for particular employees?
Only if the court finds that the Back Pay Act applies here.
Right.
The court must first find that at least one employee is subject to back pay.
Assume that we find that. Is it then correct that
if the court finds that, then there can be a compliance proceeding.
Okay.
But the court must first find that someone would be entitled to back pay.
Right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.